Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Hope everybody had a happy holiday. My guest, I'll have something to say about that in a moment. My guest is Susan Lindauer. First time I've had Susan on. I certainly won't be the last time, I hope. Susan is a journalist, and she's an anti-war activist, and she's a whole lot more than that on the things that matter most. She's a former U.S. intelligence asset. She was targeted for wanting vital truths exposed. That's the way America treats its best. You want the truth to come out, they consider you, dare I say, a terrorist? My goodness, that's today's America. It's been that way for some time. Susan can talk about that on air and other things that she may have on her mind. I know she has plenty. I want to mention that a book that she wrote, it's called Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq. And it explains her experience, and it's the experience not just she went through. Many others have gone through the same thing. When you get it straight from, as they say, the horse's mouth, you're hearing it the way it needs to be heard. Let me just make a comment about Christmas and so on. I wrote two articles on Christmas Day. One I got out on the 25th, and the other I got out yesterday. The one on the 25th I titled, No Joy to the World This Christmas. If I ever find any, I'll certainly say something about it. I certainly didn't this year, nor as many years back as I can remember. And what I said at the beginning was, I'll just read a little bit of what I said. I said, how can there be joy with wars raging out of control? Who's celebrating while mass slaughter and destruction persists? No Christmas cheer this year for billions. No Feliz Navidad. No happy holiday. No wise men spreading goodwill. No silent holy night. No decking the halls. No herald angels singing. None heard all high. No coming all ye faithful. No telling it on the mountain. No merry gentlemen resting. No peace on earth coming upon a midnight clear. No white Christmas dreams. No most wonderful time of the year. No having yourself a merry little Christmas. No holly jolly one. No wishing one in times, no wishing you one in times of war, injustice, and human suffering. Imagine them on an unprecedented scale today. No Frosty the Snowman fun. No winter wonderland. No jingle bells joy. No Auld Lang Syne. No Christmas 2014 to remember. No Santa on a sleigh. None coming to town. No gifts for billions. No peace with war winds raging. None with growing global human misery. America is Scrooge writ large. It's the Grinch that stole Christmas. That's the beginning of my article. Susan, welcome to the program. I thought I wanted to get that out. It was on my chest, and I spent a little time deciding how I wanted to phrase all of that, and that's what I wrote. I began writing it Christmas
beautiful.
Morning.
That is beautiful. The Grinch, America is the Grinch that stole Christmas from the world. That is a very appropriate image, and I like that image, it makes me sad. It's a tragic image, given the American exceptionalism. I think of this. I love this time of year because this time of year is a time for assessment and a time for facing the challenges that are coming to us next. And I like what you say. I don't like it. I don't want America to be the Grinch that stole Christmas. That is such an appropriate sentiment. We are greedy and jealous of others' achievements, other countries' assets, their resources. We're covetous. We try to steal, exactly like the Grinch. And we go around raiding other countries' treasure troves, which are finite. And we are a large country. Many of these countries are small, and they don't have as much diversification as we do. And so it our lifetime that I, outside of liberal circles, outside of progressive circles, that the notion of American exceptionalism is really under attack even in the middle class. Even the middle class who are usually asleep are realizing that something is terribly wrong. They're still, you know, uneducated, mostly uneducated, they're not vigilant, but I take it, take heart. Not heart, it's not the right word, but I feel encouraged. They are sensing it, that the age of the United States, the American century, has come to a close, and we have not even made it 100 years. I mean, the Roman Empire lasted 1,000 years. The American century lasted, you know, from World War II until today. And it's over. It hasn't survived even 70 years. And we have done this to ourselves because of our greed and our avaricious nature. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, indeed, Susan. Let me just mention this. I'm concentrating on what you're saying very hard. The sound is coming in very choppy, and I'm a little bit concerned.
Somebody just tried to telephone me, and that the call waiting was beeping. Is it better now? Let's see if it's better now.
What I was about to say was, should we try calling you back and see if we can get a better connection? Are you on a landline or a cell phone?
I'm on a landline.
You're on a landline. Let's do this.
You can call me back if you'd like.
Let's call you back. Why don't you do this? Call in on PRN's toll-free number. Now, I do that because when I get a bad line, which happens at times, I hang up and I call back, and I usually get a pretty good line. Call
that's
in
okay.
On
that's
have,
all
have,
right.
Have you got the number I sent you by email?
Yes, I do. But let's see if I did have that call coming in, and it could be that was part of the problem.
Oh, you know, it might be. You're sounding much, much better now.
Okay. Because I had that darn call was kept coming in, beeping me, and somebody whether it's a friend or someone getting excited and wanted to confirm maybe. Something that anyway. So let's just keep going with the interview.
Oh, I can comment on some of what you said. Indeed,
please.
You could say the American Empire began. The American Empire began being built, Susan, the day America became America. You know, the extermination of the native people from, as they say, sea to shining sea. And it took a while to do that. It took to the end of the 19th century. But it never stopped because the indigenous people genocide continues to this day. Included in the definition of genocide is destroying a people's culture. And Ward Churchill wrote a book called Killing the Indian, Saving the Man. In other words, you know, you destroy the culture, but you save the people, turning it into virtually nothing. And
I grew up in Alaska, so I can tell you that I can sadly affirm that the lessons from the turn of 100 years ago in the mid 1800s when this genocide was, you know, was full bore, have been repeated in terms of what happened to the Alaska Native children in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s being taken out of their homes. And being punished for speaking their native languages, being forced to go to native boarding schools. Okay, they refused to educate them in the villages. They forced them to go to boarding schools in Sitka. You know, 1,000. The Alaska is a large state, so when I say 1,000 miles from their families up in Point Barrow, I mean 1,000 miles away. They were never allowed to be with their families again. They suffered very badly psychologically from it. There's a terrible alcohol problem, and lack of family bonding, in these children. And this is from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Once the oil money started coming in, Alaska turned, and the natives had power because they had control of the lands and the money, they put their feet down and they said no. And this was at the time of the 70s, and the you know the Leonard Peltier movement in the freedom movement in South Dakota and Wyoming and Arizona, and the Indians were rising in Oklahoma. They were rising and trying to take back their power. And so at that point, the Alaska Natives rode on the bandwagon and forced the government righteously to build schools in the villages. And those are very fine schools. They, you know, as of the 70s on, there's a change, and they force them to build good schools in the villages. And they force them to have health care in the villages. And they, you know, they have very nice, they have excellent quality facilities, given that the size of the villages. And now you've seen, now they've forced the government to share the wealth with the native people. And that has been a turning point for the Alaskans, for the Alaska natives. But, you know, they are much more, by affirming their culture, you know, instead of weakening them by affirming their culture, they have been able to begin the younger generations have begun to overcome the problems that were created by the previous doctrine, which was so destructive and violent, and it was genocide. It was genocide. So you really do save the society and save the people by saving the culture. And I've been able to witness how that is the transformation from the old policy to the new, and what it actually does, and the empowerment that goes on. And it's healthy. It's just such a, you know, people who get angry about, oh, those natives, they talk about how we were so, you know, genocide, that's so old. No, it's an ongoing process.
Well, indeed.
Every generation is going to be saved or lost again.
The way we treat our own indigenous people, Susan, is the way we treat indigenous people or native people, or residents of countries around the world. It's the same thing, whether we're talking about the North Koreans in the 1950s, or the Southeast Asians in the 60s and early 70s, and what's going on in the Middle East right now, what's going on in places that never make any news stories, including proxy wars, direct wars, the rest of it. And it literally is a war against ordinary people, so rich ones can get richer and more powerful. And that's what it's all about. And that's the way America was constructed in the first place. It never was built to be a democracy. It never was intended to be a democracy. The notion that America is a democracy is a myth that the young kids begin learning. For me, it was in kindergarten, and today the ones that go to preschool, I guess they begin learning it there. And they're simply learning a myth. It simply doesn't exist. And it's probably never been more true today than the fact that America really is a very destructive terror state. They really is waging a terror campaign against ordinary people on a global basis. Back in World War II, Susan, it was in Asia against the Japanese, and it was in Europe against the Nazis. And today it's a global affair, literally. Of course, it always was in the Americas, because going back to James Monroe, who declared the Monroe Doctrine, that America was, the United States' backyard. What a dismissive term, the backyard. You know, sovereign countries belong to America, and that's the way America has always treated the Latin American and Central American nations. But they treat all nations around the world this way. I find nothing to cheer about in the way America governs at home or abroad.
Yeah, no. I agree with you. I think that my point is that we, when forced by, okay, confrontations, I agree with you. I agree with you with one caveat for hope. And that is that I do believe that though it is painful, when there is a confrontation between truth and the mythology, the American mythos, like, for example, you talked about the Native Americans a minute ago, when a brutal confrontation takes place, there is the Americans have one feature that is positive. That is a resilience and an enthusiasm almost to reinvent ourselves. so that we adjust. We have the capability. We don't, unfortunately, most of the time we don't use it. Unless there's a great confrontation, a massive pushback from the people, most of the time we don't use it because everybody's asleep and lazy. But like we were saying about the natives in Alaska, the Alaska natives rode the wave of discontent and public condemnation of what happened in the lower 48. And they were able to reinvent the structure, the whole structure, the entirety of the structure of their relationship to the state of Alaska and the federal government, such that the natives have power. And they use it wisely. And that is the mythology as well, that well, if we give them power, they're not going to know how to use it. They're not going to serve their own best interests. So we might as well keep their power from them. We should take their power for ourselves because they can't handle it. They can't handle it. And so, and what we found in Alaska, that is so condescending, that is so offensive, it's shocking that anybody would actually say those things and believe them, but we do it every day. And what we found in Alaska was that when the lower 48, when the lower 48 Indian reservations, tribes, stood up and fought back, having been decimated by disease, alcoholism, joblessness, despair, homelessness, drug addiction, and they stood back and fought to try to get some power for themselves. The Alaska natives who had only suffered from like the 1940s, the 1930s to 1940s. So their despair was not so in, it was terrible. What the horror stories that we hear in Alaska about what they did to those people is awful. But at the same time, because it was only one or two generations, the next generations rose up and they took back their power and they fought back. And they have done an extraordinary job. They're perfectly capable of managing their own businesses. They've got businesses, they've got native corporations that manage that have investments in all areas of whether it's tourism, foresting, fisheries, oil, you know, everything. They're in every kind of business. They have investments outside Alaska in the lower 48. And they have proven that they're perfectly capable of managing their own affairs. And they have educated people who are capable of doing this. And you don't need to condescend to them at all because they're right there with you. They're not the inferior people that we've pretended they are to justify these awful, despicable, decimating, genocidal policies. They're perfectly capable of fighting back. There are some who are not. The older people who went through the bad times, that the native schools were terrible, just horrible, those are the people who suffer the most. But the younger kids, they have more vigor, the younger generations who are now, I guess, my age, have full leadership capabilities, full business potential, full acumen at their disposal.
Susan, we've got about 10 minutes left. I wanted to get a couple of other topics in. One thing that is on my mind is Obama's gift to the American people this holiday season. And I believe it was yesterday that he signed two congressional acts. Congress, both houses, passed the Budget Act, and they passed the fiscal year 2014 budget and the National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA. The budget deal, number one. The budget deal is a giveaway to America's super rich and corporate America, and what's not included in the budget deal is coming later, a silent agreement between the administration and corporate America that taxes for ordinary people will effectively go up, but corporate taxes will be cut. So in other words, plans to make rich people richer and corporations richer and more powerful quickly on the NDAA 2 years ago.
Yes.
I believe it was on December 31st, 2 years ago, 2011,
yes.
Obama signed
yes.
a bill that had two provisions in it that authorized the president on his say alone, to arrest anybody in the world, including U.S. citizens, I should say, order the military to arrest them, put them in a military prison, leave them there based on any evidence or none at all, leave them there uncharged without trials, leave them there forever, possibly. And the provision passed again last year, and the same provision was in the act this year. So this was Obama's gift along with the other lumps of coal he's given America for 5 years. The idea that anybody for any reason or none can be thrown in a military dungeon for the rest of their lives, and that the rich people will be made richer and corporations will be made more powerful, and at the same time there'll be lots of cuts coming incrementally, I call it death by a thousand cuts, of important programs that ordinary people rely on.
I lived through that. I lived through the NDAA myself in my case. I was the second non-Arab American. So everybody listening to this, check out my book, Extreme Prejudice, and it's by Susan Lindauer. And you've got to know, because you hear these stories, it's like, oh, but yeah, he passed the executive order, but it can never happen. Well, actually, they've already done it, and they've done it to me. I was arrested on the Patriot Act. I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act. Secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. The government had no obligation to show any evidence that a crime had even occurred. So how do you deal with that? Well, you simply declare that there will be no trial in the case. And at that point, I was ordered to surrender to Carswell Air Force Base. I had been on a $500,000 bail, but I was ordered to surrender without trial or hearing. No, I was denied the right to a hearing. And they said that after I served my prison sentence, I would be allowed to have a hearing, but first I had to serve the time in prison, and then we would talk about the hearing afterwards. Now, when I got to the prison on the military base, I was essentially an enemy non-combatant, though I was a peace activist. I opposed violence. I opposed killing people and bombing anything, and I'd worked in anti-terrorism as a CIA asset. So my record was opposing all I had never committed any acts of violence against anybody, but I was treated as an enemy non-combatant, literally. And when I got to Carswell, they changed their tune and they said, okay, well, we've decided that we are petitioning the court to detain you indefinitely up to 10 years with no right to a trial or hearing. And we fought over the hearing. This was a big fight because I kept saying, you're required by law. I have the right to prove that I'm telling the truth. My witnesses are ready to talk. You know this is authentic. You know this is real. And this is the worst sort of corruption for you to lie to a judge and tell the judge that nobody is verifying my story, because you've interviewed these people and you know damn well they verified the story, and you know they're going to go into court and they're going to tell the judge that they told you they verified the story. They've told the FBI it's true. They've told you, the Bureau of Prison staff, it's true. And this is the Attorney General's office knows it's true. This is very easy to prove. And yet they said, oh no, no hearing, no hearing. While I was there, my uncle, who is an attorney, and at that point he had like 40 years experience in the law, at least, he was a senior attorney, very distinguished gentleman, you know, not a peacenik, not an activist personality. He's a corporate attorney, but he's a brilliant corporate attorney from the University of Chicago Law School. And he went down to that military base. He drove 700 miles so that he said he had to drive in a car so he could think without a phone ringing. He needed to think about what to do about my case because it was so extreme. And he got to the military base, and the first thing they told him was, and check this out, this is very scary, NDAA stuff. Susan Lindauer is not on this base, and there is no prison on this base. So he said, well, wait a minute, I have the court papers right here saying that Susan Lindauer is ordered by the judge to surrender to this military base. And they said, then to Carswell Prison on your military base. And they said, no, there is no such thing. There is no such place. It does not exist, and she is not here. Go away. Go away, or we will throw you in the brig. We will arrest you. And so he said, well, I'm going to file a complaint with the judge. And they said, well, you just do that, but you're not coming on our military base. He made them get the commanding officer. The commanding officer looked him straight in the eye and said, Susan Lindauer is not here, and there is no prison. The commanding officer on duty at Carswell Air Force Base told him there is no prison here. Meanwhile, other inmates were receiving visitors all the time, and they were just going right around him. They were like, yep, you go in, you go in, you go in. Nope, there's no military base. No, there's no prison here. You go in, you go in. Nope, there's no prison here. Crazy, crazy dangerous stuff. He said, I'm family and attorney. She has the right, the constitutional right to consult an attorney in her defense, and that's what I'm here to do. I have entered myself as co-counsel on her case. And I am functioning as her attorney, and you are required to let me see her. So he went back a second time, and he went and protested to the court, to the judge, to Judge Mukasey. Now, it's important to know that Judge Mukasey later became U.S. Attorney General. This is a very high-ranking judge. One of the highest judges in the entire United States is handling my case. And he goes to the judge and he says, Your Honor, this is bullshit. She has a, we demand that the court guarantee my right to see my client. And the judge said, well, so they went, my uncle made a second trip. The second trip, the court hemmed and hawed. The second trip, they smiled at him at the gate and said, yeah, there's a prison here, but there are no visiting hours on the weekend. You're not allowed to come onto our military base. She's not going to see an attorney, period. Go away, and don't come back tomorrow either. He said, I am coming back, and I'm going to come back with the U.S. Marshals, and you're going to let me onto this military base. And he went back to Judge Mukasey a second time and said, Your Honor, we demand to see Susan Lindauer. She has the absolute constitutional right to consult an attorney. They've told us there's no prison on that military base. They've told us Susan Lindauer is not anywhere in that vicinity. We demand that you produce Susan Lindauer. Because my uncle was like, you know, my uncle was receiving letters from me. He had received phone calls from me, but he knew that I was there. But the military base was fighting tooth and nail. Now imagine the difference between the Patriot Act and the NDAA. You have the same protocols, but in the NDAA, there is no judge. So there is no place to, no courtroom to, for a defense attorney to go file a complaint and say, we demand to see this person. There's no higher authority other than that military base. And if the military base says you're not going on, we refuse to acknowledge that this person is here, we refuse to let you onto our military base, there's nowhere to go protest. But anyway, so the third time, literally my uncle, who was an attorney, high-powered attorney, drove back 700 miles for the third time. This time, he was flanked by U.S. Marshals, and he had the cell phone number for the judge and the court room number, like the private number to the judge's desk. And the judge Mukasey literally had to wait in, was horrified, I think, was waiting in his chambers for that call in case that meeting did not occur. And they had to, and Judge Mukasey forced them to open up the prison, just the prison visiting center, just for me, and force the prison to allow that meeting to occur. But it took U.S. Marshals flanking my uncle at the gate to get that to occur. And that's because of the Patriot Act and the NDAA. That's what it means. You cannot comprehend how bad this really is.
Susan, I wish we could go on, but we're flat out of time, which is what the music is telling me. Your true-to-life story told by somebody who lived it is an important story to tell, an important one to hear, because it shows how America operates completely outside the law. And I must say that Carswell has held other political prisoners, and my friend Lynn Stewart is one today. We'll certainly discuss it on this program. Susan, many, many thanks. Join us tomorrow and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.